solely for economic interests. Rudy was beginning to think and sound like Ursula. This period contributed fundamentally to Rudy becoming a communist, she later wrote. Her husband was turning towards revolution. He was also trying to save their marriage. His conversion to communism was a desperate act of love. But it was too late. Rudy was caring and sweet, but in his deep brown eyes, Ursula now saw only a lifetime of conventional marriage. Richard Sorge had shown her another world of excitement, commitment, and danger. With Rudy, she was comfortable and content. But with Sorge, tearing along on the back of a motorcycle, in furtive conclave or secret assignation, she was alive. Agnes Smedley was working on a series of short stories set in China, while using her journalistic cover to pass information between Sorge, the Comintern, the CCP, and the Centre. Sorge made her a member of the Comintern headquarters staff. But the British were harassing her like ferocious dogs, she said, and her behaviour was increasingly erratic. Readers of the Frankfurter Zeitung complained that her reporting was one-sided. The newspaper also received an intelligence report, probably British, claiming she had attended a meeting in a theatre with a group of young Chinese communists whom she caroused drunkenly with and offered herself sexually to. As a finale, it was alleged, she had appeared stark naked on the platform, wearing only a red hat, and had sung the Internationale. The German newspaper was liberal, but not that liberal. Agnes was sacked. In the summer of 1932, Agnes and Ursula took a working holiday together in the mountains of Kuling in Yangtze province, just outside the communist-controlled area. As ever, the political and personal merged. The trip was an opportunity to escape the summer heat of Shanghai and rebuild their friendship while conducting some light espionage. The CCP provided a holiday bungalow. Since Mao's forces were encamped in the nearby mountains, Agnes would conduct interviews with the Chinese Soviets and their defenders, the Chinese Red Army, report some of what she discovered as journalism, and pass any secret information she gleaned back to Moscow. The five-day boat journey up the Yangtze was followed by a bone-shaking bus to the foot of the mountain and another 3 hours up steep paths in a swaying sedan chair. Initially, their relationship seemed to regain its former warmth. Agnes and I go for long walks every afternoon, Ursula wrote, with beautiful views down the Yangtze Valley and towards the Hubei mountain ranges where the Reds are. On the day Ursula wrote this letter to her parents, the Nulanses, their real names still unknown to the authorities, went on trial in Yangsu High Court, accused of financing communist bandits, directing subversive activities, arms trading with the communists, and conspiring to overthrow the Republic of China. A few days earlier, Sorge met two couriers sent from Moscow, each of whom handed over $20,000 with which to bribe the Chinese judicial authorities. In Kuling, Ursula and Agnes received word that the Nulanses had gone on hunger strike. As they sat down to lunch, Agnes announced theatrically that out of solidarity she too would eat nothing until the accused couple were released. That will not help the Nulanses, Ursula responded tartly. Without a word, Agnes rose and stalked out of the room. Ursula picked up Michael and went for a stroll. When she returned to the bungalow, a letter was waiting on the table. I cannot stay under these circumstances and have returned to Shanghai, Agnes had written. You are too preoccupied with your own personal happiness and your family. Private matters play too great a role in your life. You do not have what it takes to make a real revolutionary. Ursula was deeply wounded. Agnes must surely know me well enough to know that I was ready to take any risk. Must I exhibit my emotions in order to prove them? How could such a close friendship be damaged like this? Where had Agnes got these ideas about me? In reality, Agnes's diatribe was more personal than political. She was jealous of Ursula's relationship with Sorge and her friendship with Isa, envious of her baby and angry that she had refused to step back from espionage by agreeing with her suggestion to adopt little Jimmy. Ursula remained in Kooling, brooding on the ruptured friendship. It was a heavy blow. Word arrived that the Newlandses had been condemned to death, but the sentence commuted to life imprisonment. Ursula credited Sorge with saving their lives by bribing the judge. Ursula brooded over the accusations levelled by a woman whose ideas and friendship meant so much to her. Perhaps Agnes was right. I enjoyed life and could take enormous pleasure in everyday things. Did I perhaps attach too much importance to them? Every breath my son took was like magic to me, and I was determined to have more children, although I did not think my marriage would survive its present conflicts. Soon the hurt gave way to anger. Agnes had misjudged her. She was perfectly capable of separating personal life from political duty. She would prove to Agnes and the world that despite the demands of motherhood, she had exactly what it took to make a real revolutionary. Back in Shanghai, she described the argument with Agnes to Sorge. He changed the subject. Richard seemed to regard it as a quarrel about some matter of special concern to women and showed no desire to get involved. A veteran womanizer, Sorge knew better than to get caught up in a fight between two of his conquests. While Agnes and Ursula had been falling out, he had seduced a beautiful Chinese girl from whom he obtained the blueprints of a Chinese military arsenal. Ursula and Agnes still met up from time to time, but the friendship was gone, and both knew it. Smedley had inducted Ursula into the world of communist espionage. The American woman's fierce spirit of rebellion had inspired her. But after 2 years of undercover work, Ursula was maturing into something the volatile, egotistical Agnes would never be. A professional, dedicated, and increasingly self-confident spy. I was constantly aware of the possibility that I might be arrested, and so I hardened myself physically to improve my resistance. I didn't smoke or drink alcohol. That way I would not suffer if I was suddenly deprived of them. Agent Sonia was growing into her role. One morning in December, Ursula answered the telephone and heard the familiar voice of the Polish photographer, Grisha Hertzberg. "Come to my apartment this afternoon. Richard wants to meet you there." This was a prearranged signal to stand ready for a possible meeting. I had hardly ever been to Grisha's home, and as I understood it, I was only to come if he phoned again. Ursula waited an hour for the backup call. When none came, she went shopping. Seated around the hamburger's dining table that evening were Fritz Kuch, a teacher and keen Nazi, and two brothers, Ernst and Helmut Wilhelm, one an architect and the other an academic, and their wives. The dinner party was excruciating, the guests tongue-tied and boring, and the opportunities for useful intelligence gathering negligible. Kuch was laboriously showing slides of his expeditions into the interior, and Ursula had gone into a trance of tedium when the telephone rang in the next room. She picked up the receiver. The moment would remain frozen in memory. A framed photograph of her childhood home in Schlachtensee stood on the table by the telephone. The murmur of conversation was audible from the dining room. "I waited 2 hours for you this afternoon," said Richard Sorge. "I wanted to say goodbye." Ursula felt the room lurch. She sat down heavily in the chair. "Are you still there?" Sorge's voice came faintly from the receiver, hanging limp in her hand. "Yes," she said. "Yes, I'm here." Sorge hastily explained that he was leaving the next day. He had been recalled to Moscow. There was, he said, no cause for alarm, but he would not be returning to China. The centre wanted him elsewhere. "I want to thank you for always looking after me so well and all the others. This is only a beginning for you. Much more lies ahead. You must keep a stiff upper lip." He used the antique English phrase. "You must promise me that. But for now, all the best, the very best, and goodbye." The line went dead. Ursula could not move. She stared blankly at the wall. Grisha had forgotten to make the second telephone call, a simple error of tradecraft. I could not grasp that Richard had simply gone. Never again would he sit in this chair to talk to me, to listen to me, to advise me, to laugh with me. He had departed, and she had not even found the words to say farewell. What had I been thinking of? Had I only just realised how much he meant to me? Ursula never saw Richard Sorge again. Perhaps their romantic relationship was already over, but for Ursula, it never really ended. Ursula returned to her dreary dinner guests. No one noticed that her heart was broken. With Sorge gone, her friendship with Agnes Smedley over, and her marriage to Rudy in a state of quiet crisis, Ursula succumbed to a bout of homesickness. Carl Rimm took over the reins from Sorge. He was an efficient spymaster whose chubby frame and dozy manner belied a revolutionary's strength and passion. But he had none of his predecessor's panache. She yearned for Sorge. Without him, Shanghai seemed drained of its glamour and colour. "We now have a longing for another home," she wrote to her parents. "I feel an immense sympathy for the Chinese people. I already feel a quarter Asian. If I leave this country, I know I will always long for it." Restless, she made plans to return to Germany in the spring and introduce Michael to the rest of his family. The hot, damp climate was affecting the baby's lungs, and the German doctor had advised her to take him on holiday in Europe. Some time apart from Rudy would be good for them both. The news from Germany, however, was appalling. Nazi Party membership was soaring, and the violence between fascists and communists reaching a climax. On the 30th of January 1933, Hitler was sworn in as Chancellor, unleashing a campaign of violence and terror more brutal than anything seen so far. A month later, following the Reichstag fire, Hitler suspended civil liberties on the pretext of averting a communist putsch and then set about a ruthless confrontation with the KPD. The Nazis rounded up thousands of communists, closed down the party headquarters, and banned demonstrations. Most of the KPD leaders were arrested, though some escaped into Soviet exile. The once powerful organisation Ursula had joined was driven underground, its surviving members harried and terrorised. The Enabling Act, passed in March, gave Hitler the power to rule by decree. The Nazi dictatorship had begun, and tremors from the political earthquake reverberated to China. The Zeitgeist bookshop closed abruptly as funds from Germany dried up. Even Ursula's optimism wobbled. "It was impossible for me to understand how the German working class could permit the fascists to take power," she wrote. In Germany, many still misread the writing on the wall. The Central Jewish German Organization declared that nobody would dare touch our constitutional rights. Robert Kaczynski was not so sure. He had never been a communist, but as a prominent Jewish left-wing academic, he was a marked man. Jürgen Kaczynski was in even greater danger. After returning from the US with Marguerite, he had joined the KPD in 1930. Since then, he had written for various communist publications and even visited the Soviet Union with an official KPD delegation. On the 27th of February, while walking towards the Rote Fahne offices, he bumped into a friend who told him the Gestapo was raiding the newspaper at that very moment. Jürgen turned on his heel, avoiding arrest and almost certain death by a matter of minutes. "We are aghast at the developments in Germany," Ursula wrote home. "Only some of what is happening finds its way into the newspapers here. A heavy heart robs me of words, but we beg you to write as much as you feel able." In March, a posse of black-uniformed Gestapo banged on the gates of the Schlachtensee Villa and demanded to speak to Robert Kaczynski. Olga Moot told them he was out. The Gestapo vowed to return. Robert immediately went into hiding, first at the home of friends, then in a mental asylum. Ursula's parents-in-law, Max and Elsie Hamburger, owned a holiday chalet in Grenzbauden, a picturesque village just across the Reisenberger mountain range dividing German Silesia from Czechoslovakia. The hamburgers had already taken refuge there and agreed to shelter Robert until he could find a way to go onwards to Britain or America, where he had friends in the academic community. In April, he escaped across the border into Czechoslovakia. Displaying what he described as an almost blind loyalty in the leadership, Jürgen remained in Germany, joined the communist underground, and continued to write at excruciating length for a variety of secret party publications. Even Ernst Thälmann, the KPD leader now in hiding, found Jürgen's prolixity a little wearing. "Too much cyclical crises and not enough broken lavatory seats," he told the young statistician. Berta put down her paintbrushes and never picked them up again. She and her younger daughters hunkered down in the old family house and waited. Ursula knew that returning to Berlin would be suicidal. With her father a wanted man, anti-Semitism spreading through Germany like a rampant virus, and her comrades arrested, dead, or on the run. Her name was on the Gestapo's list of communist subversives. Refugees from Nazi violence were already pouring into Shanghai. Her journey home would have to be postponed. "The swastika is fluttering over the consulate here," Ursula told her mother and sisters. While the Gestapo was hunting for Robert and Jürgen Kaczynski, the indefatigable Tom Givens of the Shanghai Municipal Police was closing in on the Soviet spy ring. Based on the confessions of captured communists, the Irish detective had drawn up a list of foreigners suspected of being Soviet spies. Richard Sorge was on it. So was Agnes Smedley. Soon after Sorge's departure for Moscow, Agnes also made tracks for the Soviet Union. And so did Ursula. Chapter 6. Sparrow. General Jan Karlovich Berzin, chief of the 4th Department of the Red Army, was pleased with Richard Sorge. The spy codenamed Ramsey had done all and more that was asked of him. He had built up an effective web of agents, successfully navigated the fallout from the Newlands affair, and survived 3 years in Shanghai unscathed, save for a broken leg. General Berzin knew all about survival. The son of a Latvian farmer, Berzin had led a revolutionary partisan detachment against Tsarist troops and escaped twice from Siberian prison camps before joining the Red Army. During Lenin's Red Terror, he instigated the systematic shooting of hostages as an effective method of subjugation, and in 1920 he was appointed to head the 4th Department, the first Soviet military intelligence bureau. Berzin was charming, articulate, ambitious, and astonishingly brutal. A brilliant organizer with the eyes of a wolf and a glacial smile who had established a vast network of illegal spies working undercover in every major capital of the world. The 4th Department demanded total fidelity, which it frequently repaid with extreme disloyalty. If an officer or agent made a mistake, if a network was compromised, the spies were on their own. For anyone suspected of treachery, the punishment was swift and lethal. The cold-bloodedness of the centre set it apart, according to one former agent. It was entirely ruthless, with no sense of honour, obligation, or decency towards its servants. They were used as long as they were of any value, and then cast aside with no compunction and no compensation. Berzin personally debriefed Sorge in his office at 19 Bolshoi Znamensky Lane, the centre's innocuous two-storey headquarters a few hundred yards from the Kremlin, listening attentively as Agent Ramsey described the sub-agents in his Shanghai network: the Japanese journalist Hotsumi Ozaki, Chinese academic Chen Hangsheng, and red-haired radical Irene Wiedemeyer. Agnes Smedley had done excellent work, Sorge reported. Then there was the German housewife, Ursula Hamburger, an agent displaying particular promise. Manfred Stern had also reported positively on Sorge's recruit. Berzin liked the sound of Agent Sonia. In Shanghai a week later, Ursula was summoned to a meeting with Grisha Hertzberg and Karl Rimm, Sorge's successor. a message had come from the centre, a cross between an invitation, a suggestion, and an order. "Would you be prepared to go to Moscow for a training course?" asked Rim. "This will last at least 6 months, and there is no guarantee you will return to Shanghai at the end." Sorge's parting message, "This is only a beginning for you," now became clear. He must have reported fully to the Red Army Intelligence Branch and recommended her for further training. This was flattering, but surely impractical. "What about Michael?" she asked. "A condition of accepting this offer is that you must leave him somewhere else," Rim said flatly. "You cannot risk taking him to the Soviet Union, as he is bound to learn Russian there." There was an elementary, if cruel, logic at work. After training in Moscow, she must slip back into civilian life without anyone knowing where she had been. Michael was picking up languages quickly. German from his parents, and Pidgin, the Chinese-English hybrid spoken by many urban Chinese, from his nanny. If the child returned speaking even a smattering of Russian, the secret would be out. Ursula had never faced such a painful decision. She was being asked, in effect, to choose between her child and her ideological vocation, her family and espionage. "The thought of giving up my work never occurred to me," she later wrote. Like a religious zealot, she had found a single, unwavering faith around which to wrap her life. The rise of Hitler, mounting Japanese aggression, and the continuing slaughter of Chinese communists had redoubled her determination to fight fascism. A training course would underline her commitment. Perhaps she would be reunited with Richard Sorge. Under the centre's rules, agents and officers were forbidden to make contact with one another while on separate deployments. She could not write to him, nor he to her. But there was a chance he was still in Russia. Long before his departure from Shanghai, she knew that Sorge's relentlessly wandering eye had alighted elsewhere. She knew he probably did not love her, or any of his women, but she longed to see him one more time. Ambition, ideology, adventure, romance, and politics combined to make up her mind. She would go to Moscow, the capital of communist revolution. "My decision was quickly made," Ursula wrote. But where would Michael live? Berlin was out of the question. Leaving him in Shanghai was not an option, since she had been warned she might never return. After a long discussion with Rudy, they agreed that Michael would spend the next 6 months with his paternal grandparents at their chalet in Czechoslovakia, on the ostensible grounds that a change of climate would do him good. Leaving Rudy in Shanghai would not excite comment, since it was quite usual for foreigners in China to send their wives and children on prolonged home leave to Europe. Rudy believed his marriage could be saved. His own commitment to communism was growing. If the Soviet intelligence service wanted Ursula to go to Moscow, he would not, and probably could not, stop her. Misha would be well cared for by his parents, and once her training in Russia was complete, Ursula would collect their son, the family would be reunited, and they could make a new start. That was Rudy's hope. When the time came to say goodbye, he held his son tightly until the child wriggled free. Separation from her 2-year-old son would leave a permanent scar. Ursula defended that bleak decision for the rest of her life, but she never quite forgave herself. On the 18th of May 1933, Ursula and Michael boarded a Norwegian freighter bound for Vladivostok. Just before the ship weighed anchor, Grisha appeared with a large locked trunk containing documents for delivery to the centre. During the long voyage, she recited nursery rhymes to the little boy and told him stories. They spent hours talking to a canary that lived in a cage on deck. "The thought of the parting knotted my stomach," she wrote. "The weather was warm, and the scent of the timber cargo filled the air. Misha will be in his grandmother's loving care," she told herself. "The mountain air will be ideal for him." At Vladivostok docks, they were met by a Russian naval officer and escorted to the Moscow train. On the first night in their little cabin, Michael was restless, disturbed by the clatter of the tracks. I lay down beside him on the bunk until he went to sleep in my arms, and I realized once again how difficult it would be to part from my son. 9 days later, they arrived in Moscow and handed the trunk to waiting officers before boarding another train to Czechoslovakia, followed by a taxi to the little village of Grenzbauden. Max and Elsa Hamburger, now permanently resident in Czechoslovakia, warmly welcomed mother and child. Robert Kaczynski had left the chalet several months earlier and was now in England. I told Rudy's parents that we were considering a move to the Soviet Union, Ursula wrote. She explained that she would be spending several months in Moscow exploring the possibilities. The Hamburgers were not too happy about the plan, but agreed to care for their grandson as long as necessary. Ursula's mother arrived from Berlin a few days later. For Berta Kaczynski, this should have been a happy occasion, a long-awaited get-together with her eldest daughter and first grandchild. But the poor woman was utterly distracted. In the months since Robert's flight, Nazi harassment had escalated. The Gestapo returned to Schlachtensee, demanding to know where Kaczynski had gone. Jürgen's home was also raided and searched. The KPD leader Ernst Thalmann was captured at the home of a man named Hans Kluczynski, and the similarity of the names brought renewed attention to the Kaczynski family. Spelling was never a Gestapo strong point. Jürgen himself was arrested, but released after 2 hours of questioning. Secretly, he began to smuggle the family library out of the country. About two-thirds of the 50,000 volumes would be saved. Jürgen and Marguerite were now living an underground life, in constant fear of arrest. In May, the Nazis staged public bonfires of Jewish and Marxist literature, including subversive works like Agnes Smedley's Daughter of Earth. Every book in the Marxist Workers' Lending Library, created by Ursula in 1929, was put to the torch. Her friend Gabo Lewin, who had taken over as librarian, was beaten up and thrown in prison. Soon after, Berta Kaczynski performed a book burning of her own. Faithful Olga Moot stood beside the boiler furnace in the basement, shoveling in left-wing books and papers, while the rest of the family carried down anything and everything the Nazis might consider incriminating, including many of Ursula's papers. When the moment came to destroy Robert Kaczynski's handwritten manuscripts, Ollo could be heard muttering angrily, "They call themselves the Workers' Party, and everything your father wrote was to improve the lives of the workers." A few days later, the Gestapo reappeared in force, and this time they ransacked the house. "They just barged in," Brigitte recalled. "We were still in bed and had to quickly make ourselves presentable and go downstairs into one room where we were made to sit while they searched." Ollo stood by, calm and collected, arms folded. As they left in frustration, one Gestapo officer turned and spat, "We'll get her yet." Ursula was now on the wanted list, along with Robert and Jürgen. It was time to get out. Berta put the old family house up for sale and prepared to flee. The woman who appeared at the chalet in Grenzbauden was a pale, prematurely aged shadow of the glamorous mother Ursula had left 3 years earlier. Berta barely noticed her grandson. "She could not enjoy anything anymore," wrote Ursula. After just a few hours, Berta announced she was going back to Berlin. 2-year-old Michael picked up the strained atmosphere. He began to cry bitterly and kept repeating, "Mummy, stay with Misha. Please, Mummy, stay with Misha." Knowing she would be unable to control herself if she had to say goodbye, Ursula packed her bag in the dawn light, embraced Max and Elsa, and then stole away, weeping silently, while her son was asleep. The officers at the station in Moscow greeted her as Sonia. It was the first time she had heard the code name conferred on her by Richard Sorge, and she immediately recalled the bar song in Shanghai. The word brought memories of the man on the motorbike flooding back. "Perhaps that is why I liked it," she later wrote. "The name sounded like a last greeting from him." The waiting car went south and up into the Lenin Hills, the low wooded range on the right bank of the Moscow River, looking down over the city. Near the village of Vorobyevo, a name derived from the Russian for sparrow, they pulled up at the gates to a large complex of buildings surrounded by a double metal fence and patrolled by armed military police and guard dogs. This was the 8th International Sports Base, but also, more secretly, the radio training laboratory of the People's Commissariat of Defence. Unimaginatively codenamed Sparrow, this was the domain of Yakob Mirov Abramov, the Comintern master spy who had recruited Agnes Smedley back in 1926 and was now the head of communications for the Soviet intelligence services. Sparrow was equipped with laboratories, workshops, and the latest wireless technology. The top floor was a broadcasting dome with two transmitters, 500 watts and 250 watts, and a powerful Telefunken receiver. Here, some 80 hand-picked trainees of all nationalities and both sexes studied the art of clandestine shortwave radio operations, constructing transmitters and receivers, assembling and concealing wireless equipment, and coding and decoding messages in Morse. Students were also taught languages, history, and geography, indoctrinated in Marxism-Leninism, and trained in unarmed and armed combat, sabotage, mixing and handling explosives, surveillance and counter-surveillance, and all the arcane techniques of spycraft, including dead drops, brush contacts, and disguise. Before being deployed around the world, graduates of the spy school were put through arduous training at an army sports camp, a course so physically demanding they were afterwards sent to recuperate at a sanatorium in the Crimea. Mirov Abramov was a friendly, competent, and loyal comrade, but also a martinet and obsessive technical boffin who demanded dedication and total obedience from the handful of people he selected for training. One colleague wrote, "Candidates were accepted by Mirov Abramov after careful scrutiny. He proved an excellent psychologist. He invited the candidate into his office and asked whether he or she wished to make himself available to take part actively in the fight against Hitler and fascism. After several meetings, Mirov Abramov asked the candidate to sign the written conditions for this training, thereby totally committing himself the Soviet espionage system. The candidates selected were young, intelligent people with a special gift for languages or technical matters. Unsuitable candidates were eliminated by continual examinations. The trainees had to change their names and promise never to reveal their true identities, not even to their colleagues. During the training, they had to break off all links with friends, were never allowed to leave the school alone, and were not permitted to take photographs or talk to anyone about the school and their curriculum. The betrayal of secrets was punishable by death." Ursula passed the interviews with Mirov Abramov, signed the contract, and pledged her loyalty, on pain of death, to Soviet intelligence. Why did she do it? Ursula was a married woman, albeit unhappily, and a mother, a Jewish, bookish, tender, middle-class intellectual who enjoyed the ordinary pleasures of shopping, cooking, and bringing up a child. As the world slid into war, people of similar backgrounds were fleeing for sanctuary, but she deliberately turned in the other direction, running towards danger, relishing the risks. Although Ursula was open and direct by nature, her existence hereafter would be shaped by intense secrecy and deception, concealing the truth from people she loved as well as those she detested. Soviet espionage was a job for life and, not infrequently, death. Ursula looked back on the shape of her life as if it had been preordained, depicting her choices as the logical consequence of political conviction. But there was more than ideology at work. In the internal theatre of her psychology, espionage offered an opportunity to prove she was the equal of her favoured brother, a player in world affairs like her father, a more effective revolutionary than Agnes Smedley. Sparrow Spy School offered the education she had never had, and the romance that comes with membership of a secret elite. Life with Rudy offered safety and certainty. She wanted neither. Spying is also highly addictive. The drug of secret power, once tasted, is hard to renounce. Ursula had observed the babbling, inconsequential expatriates of Shanghai, knowing that she was not of them, but a person apart, with another secret existence. She had faced extreme peril for herself and her family, and she had got away with it. Survival against the odds brings with it an adrenaline high and a sense of destiny from cheating fate. Espionage is finally a work of the imagination, a willingness to transport oneself and others from the real to an artificial world, to seem to be one sort of person on the exterior, but another secret human on the inside. Since earliest childhood, in her writings, Ursula had used her rich imagination to explore an alternative reality, with herself at the centre of every drama. Now, as a trained intelligence officer, she would have the opportunity to write her own story in the pages of history. Ursula became a spy for the sake of the proletariat and the revolution, but she also did it for herself, driven by the extraordinary combination of ambition, romance, and adventure that bubbled inside her. The foreign group of trainees included two other Germans, a Czech, a Greek, a Pole, and Kate, an attractive French woman in her late 20s of great intelligence and feeling, who would become Ursula's roommate and friend. The daughter of a French dock worker, Kate's real name was Renée Marceau. She would later be dispatched to assassinate General Franco, the Spanish nationalist leader, using a false British passport in the name of Martha Sunshine. The plot failed, but she escaped from Spain and was awarded the Order of Lenin. The recruits came from utterly different worlds. Ursula found them fascinating. The group was housed together in a large red brick building on the Sparrow site, surrounded by cherry orchards. Ursula threw herself into training. All we had to do was learn. Under instruction from a former Navy radio operator, she practiced assembling a wireless from parts available in civilian radio shops and learned how to send coded messages. With daily lessons, her Russian improved rapidly. Rather to her own surprise, she quickly picked up the technical skills, learning to build transmitters, receivers, rectifiers, and frequency meters. To Ursula's delight, the group was joined by Sepp Sober Weingarten, Sorge's bibulous radio operator who had been sent back from Shanghai for a much-needed refresher course. His wife, who accompanied him, had finally twigged that Sepp was a communist spy. She was furious. The food in the compound was excellent. I blossomed. My cheeks grew rounder and rosier, and for the first time in my life I weighed over 10 stone. At weekends, Ursula went sightseeing with René, accompanied by a minder, polite but vigilant. They wandered the streets for hours. I loved the cold of the Moscow winter, she wrote. She made discreet inquiries among her instructors about Sorge's whereabouts and was told only that he had departed to take up another assignment. She was not told where and knew better than to ask. The rules were clear. Agents and officers might fraternize in Moscow and when jointly deployed, but contact at any other time was strictly forbidden. Sorge was in Japan, laying the groundwork for his next feat of espionage. Ursula's lover had moved on, emotionally as well as geographically. Soviet espionage had thrown them together and now held them apart. She wondered if she would ever see him again, and the thought made her heart twist. Memories of Sorge came rushing back when, one afternoon, in the lift of the Novaya Moskovskaya Hotel, Ursula felt a tap on her shoulder and turned to find a beaming Agnes Smedley. We fell into each other's arms, Ursula wrote. Agnes was preparing to return to China. Ursula believed the meeting was fortuitous. In fact, Agnes had almost certainly been instructed to bump into her friend and check up on her progress. Unsurprisingly, their friendship never quite rekindled. But together they called on Mikhail Borodin, the former advisor to Sun Yat-sen, who was now editing the English-language newspaper Moscow News. In the autumn of 1933, she and Agnes were given tickets to the October Revolution celebrations in Red Square. In a dazzling display of Soviet muscle, an army of athletes marched abreast under Stalin's approving gaze, carrying tennis rackets, boats, flags, and footballs in what became known as the Parade of 100,000 Singlets. Through Agnes, Ursula was introduced to other foreign communists, including the Hungarian Lajos Magyar, a journalist at the official newspaper Pravda, and Wang Ming, chief Chinese delegate to the Comintern, who, unbeknown to Ursula, had almost certainly sent Ding Ling's husband Hu Yepin to his death in 1931. "It was unusual for students at our school to meet so many people outside the collective," wrote Ursula. She was being naive, perhaps deliberately. Agnes was spying on her. She was being introduced to foreign communist luminaries to reinforce her loyalty, observe her reactions, and keep an eye on her. She was under tuition and also under surveillance. Ursula was busy, stimulated, and healthier than ever before. But she was also continuously tortured by yearning for her little son. She found she barely missed Rudy, but the separation from Michael was agony and getting worse with every day. Only René was aware of her private pain and guilt. She found herself trailing after groups of children just to hear their bright voices. My constant longing for him drew me to every child I came across. When I stood in front of shops and saw the prams standing outside, I could understand how women could steal children simply in order to change their clothes, feed them, and hear them gurgling. Michael's third birthday came and went. They had been apart for 7 months. Ursula knew she would never be able to recoup those lost months. Michael was growing up fast, more than 1,000 miles away, while she built radio transmitters in a guarded camp, making friends with people whose real names she did not know. Her duty as a mother was to be with Michael, but her other duty was stronger. Sometimes, late at night, she cried, but she never once thought of quitting. A week after Michael's missed birthday, Ursula was summoned to the centre on Bolshoi's Namensky Lane. A major commended her progress and then abruptly informed her, "You are soon going to be sent away to Mukden in Manchuria." The region of northeast China and Inner Mongolia, known as Manchuria, had been invaded by the Japanese in 1931, who renamed it Manchukuo and installed a pro-Japanese puppet government. The Japanese occupiers were battling widespread Chinese resistance, from citizen militias, peasant brotherhoods, bandit gangs, and partisan armies with names like the Big Swords and Red Spear Societies. The most vigorous insurgency was being mounted by the Communist Underground Network, backed by the Soviet Union, which regarded expansion of Japanese power into China as a threat. Ursula's task in the city of Mukden, now Shenyang, would be to liaise with the communist partisans, provide them with material assistance, and transmit military and other intelligence to Moscow by radio. "The political situation in Manchuria was very interesting," she later wrote, with studied nonchalance, "and Mukden was a focal point." It was also spectacularly dangerous. The authorities in Shanghai had rooted out thousands of communist rebels, but the Japanese Kempeitai, or secret military police, was in a different league. Brutal, racist, and extremely efficient. This was an important mission, a mark of how high she had risen in the estimation of her spy bosses. But it was also one she might not survive. Ursula was now a captain in the Red Army, though no one informed her of the promotion or told her she held any rank at all. I accepted this surprising task without hesitation, she later wrote. The Major's next statement, however, pulled her up short. You won't be working there alone. A comrade with overall responsibility for the mission will go with you. It's important for him that you already know China. I would prefer to send you there as a married couple. She was momentarily speechless. Don't look so shocked. Ernst is a good comrade, 29 years old, and you'll get on well together. That's out of the question, she protested. In Shanghai, Rudy and I are well known, and people from Shanghai frequently go to Mukden. I'm officially taking home leave in Europe, so I can't suddenly turn up with a false passport as someone else's wife. It's completely unrealistic, unless I get a divorce from Rudy, and that would take time. She was not ready for divorce. In addition, she was not sure she liked the idea of a fake marriage. What if we don't get on? We're going to be bound together for a long time in clandestine isolation. The Major grinned. The work is vital. Wait until you meet him. The following day, she was briefed on the Manchurian mission by Colonel Gaik Lazarevich Tumanyan, the head of the Asian section. Tumanyan was an Armenian with a long, slender face, dark curly hair and dark eyes. A veteran Bolshevik who had risen up through the Red Army ranks despite his kind soul and gentle nature. Tums had spent several years working undercover in China and knew exactly how much he was asking of Ursula. I soon realized that I was dealing with an intelligent person, an expert in his field, who had trust in me, she wrote. Tumanyan greeted her with a broad smile. The marriage idea has been abandoned, he said, regrettable as this might be for the comrade concerned. His laughter was infectious. The colonel explained that she should return to Shanghai to see Rudy. She had told him they would be parted for 6 months. She had already been away for 7. Once there, she should arrange a suitable job in Mukden as cover and then travel on to Manchuria with her new colleague. Ernst was a seaman from a working-class background, he told her, and an experienced radio technician. Ursula had one more question. Tell me, does he know that I have a son? Has anyone thought about the baby? Tumanyan smiled again. You had better tell him about that yourself. A few days later, Ursula spotted a child's fur hat in a shop window and immediately bought it. In Manchuria, they have cold winters, and this little hat could fit the boy. I imagined him wearing it over his blonde hair, blue eyes, and soft skin. Later the same day, she found herself in a bare and unheated room in the centre, awaiting the comrade who would be her new partner in espionage. She wondered if it was the cold or the anxiety that made her teeth chatter. Finally, a man entered, tall and slim with the broad shoulders of someone used to hard work. We shook hands fleetingly. I felt my fingers cold in his warm hand and took in his blonde hair and large furrowed forehead, too big for his face, the strong prominent cheekbones, blue-greenish eyes with sharply etched and narrow lids. For a moment, they appraised each other. You are shivering, he said. Are you cold? Before I could answer, he had taken off his coat and hung it around my shoulders. The coat reached almost to the floor and was very heavy, but inside I felt lighter. Ernst's real name was Johann Patra. A 34-year-old sailor from the port city of Klaipeda, he was Lithuanian by birth, German in speech and manner, and communist by adamant conviction. Highly intelligent, but wholly uneducated, he spoke German, Lithuanian, Russian, and English, but struggled to read in any language. In the late 1920s, the young seaman had been talent-spotted by a Bulgarian officer in Soviet intelligence and began doing odd jobs for the Comintern, acting as a courier as he sailed between Hamburg, Riga, and other ports. In 1932, he was brought to Moscow to be trained, first in sabotage and then radio operations. Ursula's first conversation with her new boss was exceptionally awkward. Patra spoke in monosyllables, demanding to know if she could operate an illegal transmitter. It soon became clear that he knew more about radio operating than I did. They were still standing up. After another long silence, he said, "That hat there you're screwing up in your hands is a bit small for you, isn't it? I don't think it would fit you at all." "It's not for me, it's for my son." Patras stared in surprise. "You have a son?" "Yes, Michael is 3 years old and I'm taking him with me. Have you got any problems with that?" She had already made up her mind. "I would not allow us to be split up again unless I were involved in a revolution or the armed struggle of the partisans. If he refused to accept the boy, I would not go." She had even prepared a speech. "If you think that a child would affect my independence and my inability to work, that as a mother I would be less likely to withstand the dangers, then we must talk with the boss and see if he can find you a different colleague." She waited. Suddenly, Patra smiled for the first time. "Why would I object to your son?" he said. "After all, the revolution needs a younger generation." Ursula felt a flood of relief. A week later, Ursula was ushered into the presence of General Jan Berzin himself. Clean-shaven, bright-eyed, and youthful in appearance, but grey-haired, gruff, and all business. Berzin told her to meet Patra in Prague, then collect her son and go south to Trieste on the Adriatic coast. He handed her a pair of tickets for an Italian liner sailing to Shanghai. When she encountered Patra on board, it must appear to be for the first time. They should pretend to have an affair and then head to Manchuria together. "If not marriage, at least pretend you belong together," Ursula was told. "That's the best way for you to make your situation in Mukden seem believable. He'll be registered as a businessman, and you will have to support him in that role." Here was a cover story that might have come from Ursula's own pen. An unplanned meeting, an impulsive shipboard romance, and an elopement. Chapter 7. Aboard the Conte Verde. On a crystal-cold March morning in 1934, Ursula left the Blue Star Hotel in Prague and set off to meet Johann Patra. Beside the Vltava River, she wrote, "The bare branches of the trees were coated in frost. Misty clouds lay over the river and drifted upwards into the blue where they became transparent, broken like a very fragile veil." Ursula's excitement was tempered by a grinding anxiety. The following day, she would be collecting Michael from his grandparents after a 7-month separation. Would he remember her? Then there was Patra, her senior officer, her new partner, handsome but unreadable. What if, with the best will in the world, we were not suited to each other? Ursula was not always easy to live with, and she knew it. "Even some good people get on my nerves to such an extent that I can't stand another hour with them, particularly humourless people, or those who are boring and thick-skinned. On the other hand, it may be that others find I get on their nerves." The first meeting with Patra, when he had draped his coat around her, had contained a peculiar undercurrent, a flicker of tension. Perhaps he was doubtful about working with a woman. "He needs to know that he's got a tough mate who will do her share of the work whatever happens," she reflected. But had she put him off by being too outspoken and hard-nosed? She spotted Patra sitting in the corner of the cafe near the market, oddly conspicuous with his wide shoulders and shock of fair hair. He was hunched in concentration over a newspaper, a finger tracing the words on the page. As they rehearsed the details of the mission, Patra seemed as taciturn as before. But then suddenly he brightened. "Let's go to the cinema." This was not part of the plan. But he was the senior officer and, besides, she had seen posters for a French film she wanted to see, La Maternelle, showing at a nearby basement cinema. As they settled into their seats and the movie began to roll, Ursula realised that she had chosen the wrong sort of film. La Maternelle, Children of Montmartre in its international version, is set in an orphanage and tells the story of an abandoned child longing for a mother's love. For Ursula, emotionally fragile after the long separation from her own son, the drama was too much. 10 minutes into the first reel, she began to weep. Tears were streaming down my face. I was powerless to stop them. I cursed myself for my own weakness. I gripped the arms of the chair tightly, but the tears poured down. Mortified at what Patra must be thinking, she whispered, "I'm not usually like this." He put a consoling arm across her shoulders. "I'm glad you're like this." That evening, over supper, Johan opened up. Her eyes still swollen from crying, Ursula felt her emotions well up again as he described his own hard-scrabble childhood. His father, a fisherman, had spent his wages on drink and frequently beat his wife and children. His mother, stalwart and patient, had sacrificed happiness to bring up 4 children, of whom he was the eldest. "I never forgot the respect with which he spoke about his mother," she wrote. Patra recalled how his father had returned home one night, raging with drink. The 15-year-old boy had interposed himself to protect his mother, but he was no match for the older man, an experienced fighter. The fisherman beat his son to a pulp and threw him out of the house. Patra immediately signed on as a cabin boy on a merchant ship and never returned to Klaipeda. Over the next 5 years, he worked first as a stoker, then a radio operator. He was introduced to communism by a shipmate. Gradually, word by painful word, he waded through the writings of Marx and Lenin. While his mates played cards, went ashore, or relaxed between watches, he struggled with the foreign words and long, complicated sentences he did not understand. For Ursula, surrounded by books and ideas, communism had come effortlessly. For Patra, it had been almost impossibly difficult. "There probably never was an easy way for Johan," she reflected. At the end of the evening, the Lithuanian sailor walked her back to the Blue Star, shook hands formally, and disappeared into the night. The next day, as the train chugged towards Grensbauden, Ursula's excitement and apprehension rose in tandem. "Every minute brought me nearer to my son." Inevitably, the longed-for reunion was a disappointment. A 3-year-old child understands when he has been abandoned. "A strange boy stood before me, and I was strange to him too," she wrote. "My son did not even want to greet me. He ran to his grandmother and hid behind her skirts." For 3 days, Michael refused to speak to her. When he did, he addressed her furiously in the Chinese pidgin English that was still his first language. "Me thinky Grensbauden side much more nice than Shanghai side. But me want she mummy and daddy by and by come too and stay plenty time topside house which belong Grossmutti." Ursula felt a fresh stab of guilt. The boy wanted his mother and father back, here, in the hills of Czechoslovakia. Finally, she had to drag the screaming child out of the house and into a waiting car. To make matters worse, he had caught whooping cough. Every few minutes, he emitted a hacking cough and his face turned blue. As the train rolled south to Trieste, she wondered, "Will my puny sparrow die?" The next morning, they climbed up the gangplank of the SS Conteverde. The great ocean liner was the pride of the Lloyd Triestino line, accommodating 640 passengers in 3 classes. On their first day at sea, Ursula spotted Patra across the saloon. He was travelling as a privately wealthy businessman with a cover job as representative of the Rheinmetall typewriter company. They avoided eye contact. The 3-week voyage would take them south through the Adriatic and Mediterranean to Cairo, then via the Suez Canal to Bombay, Colombo, Singapore, and finally Shanghai. For the first few days on board, the sickly Michael was confined to their second-class cabin. In his feverish state, the little boy was seized by sheer panic, imagining that the steamer could sink and he and his mother would drown. Ursula held him tightly, his damp little body shaking. The child remained wary, but slowly their relationship improved, along with his health. After they had read the illustrated book of children's verse for the 30th time, she decided cabin fever was more of a danger than whooping cough and brought him up on deck, though she carefully kept him away from any other children to prevent infection. The Conte Verde was a floating palace,